international finance. We're looking at the structure and operation of the international financial system. We want to understand all the key legal issues involved. I've provided a basic outline for everything that will be considered. Contract structures, finance options, relevant terms and conditions, related legal issues. We'll look at markets and definitions, historical development, City of London, coffee houses, financial markets, Eurodollar markets, Bretton Woods. I've provided materials on all of this. We'll look at the main markets, we'll look at the main definitions. In terms of the core contracts, we'll look at the loan market, we'll look at the bond market, the project finance market, securitization markets, and derivatives markets. Contract parties. All of the core standard terms and conditions have the same key elements. We have the financials, we have the obligations, we have the defaults. The obligations principally consist of the conditions precedent, the representations and W's, and the covenants, which build on the financials. The financials will be the amount, interest, repayment term, the duration, drawdown, payment and repayment. The defaults set out the conditions in the event of which banks can trigger their rights and recovery so that they can protect their interest in the deal. What we're going to do is ensure that all of these key three sets of provisions all interrelate and are connected with each other. The financials have to be supported by the obligations, and the obligations are confirmed and given effect to, implemented through the events of default. We'll go back and look at all of this in further detail. Because we're looking at the international loan market and the bond market, the specific additional provisions that apply in the loan area are the syndication. It's the nature of the relationship between the banks which form the syndicate, so we need to look at syndicate relationships, syndicate principles, and we will distinguish and identify all of those. We also need to look at lead bank and agent bank function. We'll also, in connection with bond markets, we'll look at the role and function of the managers. We'll look at bondholder meetings, trust holder meetings, negotiability, admission to listing and admission to trading, which are separate. Admission to listing is to make a public offer. Admission to trading is to sell the specific bond on a particular stock market and exchange. There's a series of other specific contractual sets, relationships, types of transaction we'll look at in further detail, infrastructure finance or project finance, asset-backed finance or securitization, where we transfer assets from the banking and loan market into the securities market. We'll look at derivatives financing and the development of specific types of contract to manage other ancillary risks in the financial system, principally foreign currency risk and interest rate risk. All of this develops with the collapse of the Bretton Woods system during the early 1970s. So we need to look at all of the new types of contracts which emerged from this time. Principally, swaps is an obligation, an exchange of undertakings, which could be foreign currencies, it could be interest rates, it could be any other type of asset or commodity. Futures is an obligation to buy or sell at a future time, price and amount. An option is the right to buy or sell at a future time, price and amount. We'll also look at credit derivatives and other ancillary instruments. There's also other specific types of finance we'll refer to. Title finance, leasing, acquisition finance, senior and subordinated debt financing, mainly used in the mergers and acquisition area. We'll also refer to secured financing, state financing and structured financing. There's a series of special additional legal issues we want to consider, mainly with regards to financial regulation, the fact that we cannot set up any formal regulatory structure, so we need to manage this on an internal market-based model. It's a self-regulatory model because there is no government or international organisation large enough to control these very large markets. We'll look at asset transfers. How do we transfer loan commitments? Assignment, legal and equitable, novation, participation, sub-participation, risk participation, other forms of economic interest transfer, such as securitization, trust and agency. We'll also mention legal opinions, financial remedies and public international law, so that we can understand how all of this works and operates with regards to the contracts that we are looking at. I have provided a series of tables on the system which summarise all of this in further detail. We can understand the structure, nature, and operation of the international financial system from this table. It's basically looking at the money and banking markets, the credit markets on the left, the capital markets and other asset markets on the right. Money markets principally consist of the primary money and secondary money markets. Primary money market in which the central banks intervene. Secondary money markets, other markets for wholesale debt between principal market counterparties. The money markets are wholesale and only up to 1 year. Anything in addition to that is part of the larger, wider banking market. Banking market also includes the corporate loan market, consumer credit market, commercial property market, residential mortgage market, and trade finance. We'll also include within this the euro loan market. Is the euro loan section part of the larger international euro dollar system? The euro dollar market emerges after the Second World War, principally based in London. It's still based in London, principally consisting of an underlying interbank market, as well as a euro loan market, a syndicated lending market, and a security-based bond market. The subsequent history of the bond market is then one of shorter duration as we go down from long bonds to medium-term notes, 15, 10, 5-year notes, down to shorter euro notes, and then commercial paper up to 1 year. Principally, essentially, in law, if it's a bond, it's fixed interest rate. If it's a floating interest rate, it's a note. There's also a series of other issues that we can raise in terms of loan transfer. Again, I've just summarised the core issues there. Assignment, novation, participation, risk participation, securitisation, trust and agency. With regards to bank structures, operations, we can summarise these in terms of subsidiary, branch, joint ventures, consortia and representative offices. The consortia is the syndicate. Well, a consortia formally is a joint venture set up between two separate banks so they could participate in the euro loan market. So a consortia is like a joint venture. So banks come together to form a relationship. The syndicate is then the separate, specific set of relations they will enter into with other borrowers to lend in the euro loan markets. A representative office is whereby you have an office to represent your interest in another jurisdiction, but it's only an office. It doesn't have separate regulatory entitlement to carry on business in that other office. However, many of the activities that we're looking at in the euro loan area, in the euro dollar markets, are unregulated anyway. To conduct euro loan business, to lend, to borrow in the interbank markets, and to lend in the euro dollar markets are not regulated activities as such. We've also obviously got subsidiaries and branches. A subsidiary is where you set up a separate legal entity in another country to conduct business. A branch is where you transfer your own existing legal business from one country into another using the legal personality of the home state. And a joint venture is when two banks come together. A consortia is just a specific type of joint venture that was developed in the euro dollar area. We can also then summarise all of the other international financial markets. We have the securities and capital markets, principally the debt and equity markets. Warrants and hybrids allow you to borrow more or buy more of the same thing at an agreed price and time. Hybrids are just various forms of mixed interest instruments. Depository receipts are securities which evidence other securities. You deposit the security and you receive a receipt for that, which becomes a new security. And very often you can buy and sell that, which is not subject to the same restrictions which have applied to the other security. A depository receipt is similar to a certificate of deposit. On the left-hand side, a certificate of deposit on 1, 2, D and E. When you deposit a very large amount of money with a bank, you get a separate receipt for that, which evidences that deposit. You can buy and sell that. It's a form of note. And we'll come back and I'll define all of the notes and the key legal entitlements of each of these. We've also then got the euro-dollar market. So on the capital market side, it's the bond market, then the shorter duration note market, and then the commercial paper market up to 1 year. We've also got convertibles, which convert from one instrument into another, as well as callables, which again is an entitlement to purchase something else. The new type of instrument that's been developed for regulatory purposes more recently are the CoCos, contingent convertible obligations, which are bonds which can convert into equity so that you can use that to absorb losses in the event of a financial crisis. Following the global financial crisis, banks had to increase their capital requirements, their core regulatory obligations, the capital they had to hold against their commitments. Basically, if you lend, any amount of lending had to be supported by 8% capital. That was then increased from 8% to around 12.5%. You also now have to hold an additional lending capacity under what's called a TLAC that will now also include these CoCos. So this has become very important for regulatory purposes. These are essentially bonds which can be converted into equity, and then the regulated authorities can write them off in the event of financial difficulty or collapse of the institution. We've also then got the structured finance markets. The structured finance markets emerged just before the global financial crisis. These are essentially an extension of the earlier securitization markets. With securitization markets, we're going to take a pool of banking assets, we're going to convert them into medium-term notes or notes, and we do that by selling them to a special purpose vehicle, which then sells new notes to pay for the pool. Structured finance is where you then re-securitize the new notes you've just created. So we securitize securities. That's structured finance. It's a form of secondary level securitization or re-securitization, whereby we securitize existing securities. So we're going to create a whole series of new notes, a form of securities when we securitize. But what we will then do is we can bring together 50, 100, 200, 300, up to 350 separate securitizations, and we can securitize all of these again. We transfer all the payment obligations, all the payment entitlements up to another SPV. We call that a collateralized debt obligation, a CDO. That's collateralized, that's structured finance. If all of the assets are of the same class, we will follow the class designation. So if they're all loans, it's a CLO, collateralized loan obligation. If they're all bonds, it's a collateralized bond obligation. If it's all equity, it's a collateralized equity obligation, CEO, CBO, CMO, CLO. The collective term, or the term we use when there's any mixed assets within it, is a CDO, a collateralized debt obligation. It's a form of secondary or re-securitization. We take all the existing securities, for example, 5,000, 10,000 existing securities. We securitize each of these assets, these lending assets, up with one SPV. We then take all of these separate SPVs and we re-securitize all of these to another SPV. And we could have up to 350 securitizations in a CDO. But what we can then do again is this, and I'll come back and show you tables on this. We can take that CDO and we can take up to 35 CDOs and we can re-securitize these to another higher level SPV. We call that a CDO squared. And then we can take 5 CDO squareds and we can securitize them again up to another higher level SPV. We call that a CDO cubed. So we have securitization. We have structured finance or secondary securitization creating CDOs, and then we have CDO squareds and CDO cubes. We've then got financial derivatives markets, we mentioned already, developed from the 1970s onwards with the collapse of the Bretton Woods system. Essentially, swaps, futures and options in the 1980s, 1990s. Credit derivatives are essentially a form of guarantee or insurance without having to comply with insurance law and all of the additional obligations which it imposes in relation to contracts ubere mai fidei, which means of utmost good faith, and then other hybrid instruments. We then have the alternative investment markets. These are other specialist high income markets where wealthy individuals or even governments or other institutional investors, they want to place funds to raise additional income. We call this search for yield, SFY. We want higher search for yield, and especially when you have low interest environments, as we have had for the last 10 years, up to the most recent period, there was a very significant search for yield. How can we do that? We have the hedge fund market, private equity market, and sovereign wealth funds market. And we'll come back and look at all of these in further detail. We then have the currency markets, the gold markets, insurance markets, and commodity markets for buying and selling other types of metal, securities, agricultural products, or virtually anything else. Gold and silver are commodities. I've referred to the gold market separately here, although they are, gold's not money, it's simply an investment asset. We can then understand international loan finance and all of the other core transaction areas that we're looking at through a series of tables. International loan finance, what have we got? We've got the borrower and the borrower's group. We've got a group of syndicate members. We have an arranging or lead bank that's going to set all of this up. We will have an agent bank that's going to administer the facility during its duration, and then possible guarantors. In practice, what will happen is each of the borrower and the borrower's connected companies, usually its subsidiaries, will act as guarantors. This creates additional issues in law, in that one company cannot legally, technically guarantee another company just to guarantee another company. There has to be a legitimate commercial justification for doing so. In practice, what we will want to do is we will take board resolutions from each of the companies concerned, and they will state that, for example, in relation to a syndicated lending structure, each of the borrowers can borrow more on more favourable, cheaper terms than would otherwise be available in the market if it did so on a solo basis. Therefore, by joining these other borrowing companies and participating in this specific facility, we can borrow more at a cheaper rate. That's the traditional justification we will use, but we will need to ensure that that's actually set out in a board resolution, and we will obtain that as part of the conditions precedent documentation that we are going to require. I've summarized on here the possible use of loan facilities. We will see euro loans, multi-purpose facilities or MOFs, term and revolving facilities, credit lines, title finance, project finance, property finance, acquisition finance, securitization, and subordinated debt. We can use term loans in all of these areas. And again, what are the three core sets of provisions? We have the financial provisions, we have the obligations, and we have the defaults. And again, I've summarized on these on the front page. So term, top left, principal, amount, duration or term, the drawdown, the interest, the repayment and possible prepayment. And then bottom left, we have the obligations. We have the conditions precedent, the representations and warranties, and the covenants. For the conditions precedent, we're going to need copies of all the relevant constitutional documentation, principally memorandum and articles of association for each of the companies concerned. Other sovereign confirmations, if it's a state, any security confirmation if it's relevant, legal opinions to confirm the enforceability of everything in each relevant jurisdiction which applies, other confirmations of evidence and other conditions subsequent. This will also include board resolutions as well as specimen signatures so that we confirm that all documents are properly executed by the relevant parties. All of this has to be confirmed as part of the larger execution procedure, negotiation and execution arrangements which will be entered into. We then have representations and warranties, statements of fact rather than law or opinion, and we will have a series of legal warranties and financial or commercial warranties. These will then overlap with the subsequent covenants, and the specific covenants are the corporate covenants, principally the negative pledge, the pari passu and the disposal clause. We'll also have financial covenants, information covenants, and general undertakings. We then support these. We're going to protect and execute these, give effect to these in practice by tying those into the events of default. If there's a breach of any major provision, the banks need to be able to exercise the rights and entitlements to act. I've summarized the remedies on the right-hand side in red. Suspension of further drawdown, cancellation of all further drawdown, acceleration of repayment, rescind the document if necessary, and go for separate outside judicial enforcement action, sue for damages on the basis of the contractual obligations entered into. We then support those with the default clauses. The default is non-payment, principal non-payment, either of interest or principal, repayment of principal. Breach of financial covenants, breach of non-financial instruments, misrepresentation, cross-default, insolvency, and then equivalent to insolvency are other creditor processes, loss of control without assumption of obligation, illegality, repudiation, and then the material adverse change. In practice, the two most difficult sensitive clauses I've marked in red are the cross default and the MAC clause. Cross default, if we trigger cross default under this document, this will then trigger cross default on all other legal obligations in similar terms. At the same time, as default in all other outstanding obligations will trigger a cross default on this one. We need to be very careful. We don't want to make it too easy to trigger the cross default, because very often that triggers default across all commitments, which inevitably leads to insolvency. And if you have too many lenders, too many creditors involved, it's very difficult to negotiate and to come up with any responsible form of rescheduling. In practice, we're always going to want to reschedule, and I've summarised that bottom right. So we have rescheduling. We're usually always going to want to reduce the interest, extend the term. The banks will be very reluctant to actually cancel the full repayment, cancel the total amount due, but they will very often reduce the interest as necessary and extend the term. We also have formal arrangements at the international level. There's a Paris club and a London club for negotiating sovereign loan, sovereign commitments between countries, and then between banks and countries, and either under the Paris club or the London club. And then we also have separate formal negotiation provisions provided for through the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, principally in relation to HIPICs, highly indebted borrowers, and we've renegotiation provisions provided for those. I've also mentioned on here, you'll see, for example, loan transfers, assignment, novation, participation, risk participation. We can also add securitization, trust and agency. Controls we have to watch: fraudulent misrepresentation, criminal liability, statutory liability, Unfair Contract Terms Act and the Misrepresentation Act. What we're concerned about here is this issue of liability. I've summarised that slightly further up. We can have liability in terms of theft, fraud, misrepresentation, which is fraudulent, negligent or innocent, and then we can have regulatory liability. Theft is corporate deceit under the Theft Act 1968. There are various ways of controlling that. I've tried to summarise them on the left-hand side. I've provided a separate paper on the system which explains all of the liability issues and how we control this in practice. So, exclusion clauses are legal at common law, although there has to be express provision. It's construed contra pro ferentem, CP, which means the person drafting has the clause negotiated, construed against them, against their interest, because that prejudices the other party. These can be overwritten by a separate oral warranty or separate representation. We can also exclude, we have what we call basis clauses, where we exclude duties and obligations. Therefore, we cannot be held liable for something that we were not responsible for in the first case. We call these no duty clauses or basis clauses. Again, all of this can be effective in practice. It's just that exclusion cannot cover certain types of things which I've listed at the bottom, we referred to already. You cannot exclude liability for fraudulent misrepresentation, criminal activity, statutory liability, where it's unreasonable and you breach the terms of the Unreasonable Contract Terms Act 1977, and then that's expressly imported, incorporated into misrepresentation situations under the Misrepresentation Act 1967. Which creates this new form of statutory misrepresentation in addition to misrepresentation at common law and fraudulent misrepresentation at common law. Effectively, what statutory misrepresentation under the 1967 Act does is it reverses the burden of proof. under the common law, you had to effectively establish fraud. But that was very difficult. So what we can now do is, if you can establish misrepresentation, the onus transfers to the other party. They have a defence that there was reasonable belief for the statement that was made. So effectively, you transfer the obligation of proof, you reverse the burden of proof, and transfer that to the other party, has to prove that they had reasonable belief for the statement they made. Otherwise, they'll be liable for statutory misrepresentation, which is much easier to establish. The point simply is this: in all of the documents we're going to enter into, the clients will always exaggerate. Parties always overstate things. As lawyers, we need to be very careful to ensure that everything is proper and valid, can be supported by relevant evidence, and if it is not, we will score it out. We will redline it, because otherwise the parties are creating liability for themselves. And that liability will then trigger breach. We'll see misrepresentation as an express event of default, although you will also have separate liability for innocent, statutory, and negligent, fraudulent misrepresentation. The key protection that we're trying to look at in all of these cases, and this applies again with regards to negotiating the CPs, the reps and Ws, and the Cubs, and I've summarised it on the provision there on the table on the left-hand side in grey. The representations and warranties, if you breach those, you only get damages. What the banks want is rescission. They want the right to rescind, because therefore it puts them in a much stronger position in renegotiating with the borrowers, which triggers the renegotiating on the bottom right there. So what we're trying to do is this: we're trying to elevate representations to warranties, and then representations and warranties to conditions, so that in the event of breach of those, we get full rescission. In practice, we won't trigger rescission, because if we trigger rescission, that's going to trigger cross default. However, it puts us in a much stronger position to conduct the renegotiating bottom right. We can then look at the relationship between the euro loan market, loan transactions, and bond markets. What we will simply see is, in the bond area, we have a large number of additional parties, therefore there's a large number of additional documentation. So what we're going to do is, the provisions that we will explain and extend and apply, the financials, the obligations, and the defaults in the loan documentation will be spread out over separate documents in a bond deal. With regards to documentation in the loan deal, you need the mandate letter, is instructing the agent bank, giving it legal authority to negotiate, set up the syndicate, and then enter into the documentation. You have the information memorandum, is a statement of fact which explains the background to the business of the borrower, the borrowers, the likely use and application of the funds, and how the funds that are drawn down will be repaid over time. And then the loan agreement itself. In the loan deal, all of the core legal provisions, all of the obligations, rights and entitlements are set out in the loan agreement. We only need one core document. In the bond situation, it's slightly more complex. I'll just highlight again, bottom left, even though we have one loan agreement, we may have one borrower and possibly, let's say, nine subsidiaries, so that's 10 borrowers. We may have 10 members of the syndicate. We only need one loan agreement. But there's not just one loan. Every drawdown is a separate loan, and then every drawdown is effectively a separate loan between each of the drawdown borrowers and each of the banks. Strictly speaking, it's each borrower drawing from the banks collectively, but what you will see when you look at the actual terms in the standard documentation that's produced, all of these provisions are specified to be separate and divided and distinct, so that each of the rights of the banks against the borrowers is separate. So what we then do is this: although there's one loan document, if we've got 10 borrowers and 10 banks, and we've got two facilities, a fixed term facility and then a revolving repayment facility, which is like an overdraft which rolls over, repay, roll, repay, drawdown, repay, drawdown, repay, drawdown, we can then create multiple loans under a single loan agreement. And the multiplication can work very simply. So 10 companies, 10 syndicates, two facilities, that's 10 times 10 times 2, 200 already. But if we have an A and a B, and there's a commitment period, and we can draw down, for example, once a month for up to 2 years, that's times another 24. So that's 2,400. And then if the revolver is made available either for the 2 years, that's 2,400, or if it's made available for, say, 10 years or 20 years, that becomes 24,000. So altogether, we can have up to 26,400 separate loan obligations under one single loan agreement. Now, in terms of the actual documentation itself, you'll have specific provision in the documentation which provides for division of loans and for consolidation of loans, and there'll also be a limit on the number of loans. It might say, for example, 10,000 or 5,000. But what you can then do is you can consolidate and you can divide to stay within that limit. The key provision from the borrower's perspective are the commitment periods. It needs to see what the commitments are. For how long can I draw down? If let's say 100 million, can I only draw that 100 million down in the first 2 years? If it wants all 100 million, it has to draw it down within 2 years, otherwise it will lose the availability and still be paying for it. Not full interest rate, but it'll still be paying a commitment fee under the documentation. In the bond area, we're going to have slightly more complex structure. We're going to have the issuing company. It's not going to sign a loan document this time. It's going to issue the funds in the form of transferable securities, in the form of bonds. Fixed interest rate or bonds, floating rate or notes. You're going to have the issuer. It's going to be selling them to the investors. They could be public institutions or private investors. If it's a very large issue, we're going to have a selling group. And just in case the selling group can't sell or dispose of everything, we'll have an underwriting group to purchase any bonds which aren't sold through the selling group. If it's a large issue again, we'll have a trustee acting on behalf of the bondholders, so we'll then have to have bondholder meetings. If we have a trustee, we still need an agent to administer the facility. It's the same in the loan deal and in the bond deal, except if there's a trustee, that already creates a trust relationship which can hold funds on trust on behalf of the bondholders. So if you have a trustee, you only have a paying agent. If you don't have a trustee, you have a fiscal agent, because you have to create, import a fiduciary relationship. And all that will then happen is, for each of these sets of parties, each of these relationships, we have an additional documentation. So we'll have the subscription agreement, we'll have the selling group agreement, we'll have the underwriting agreement, there'll be the trust deed. In this case, we'll have a prospectus, which is the equivalent of the information memorandum in the loan deal, which sets out all the information about the borrower's business, the use and application of the funds, and how the funds will be repaid. That prospectus can also become the listing particulars if we're going to list this on a particular exchange. Again, we have admission to listing, which is permission to sell to the general public, provided by our listing authority in any major country, which is now the Financial Conduct Authority in the UK, which was formerly the London Stock Exchange. But also we have admission to trading, where we're going to be trading on a particular exchange. So admission to trading and admission to listing. So the prospectus is the equivalent of the information memorandum. It will also then become the listing particular if we're applying for listing. Just in terms of timelines, this is a typical type of deal, usually over around a 4 week period. Initial marketing and approaches, including mandate letter, pre-launch, D-Day minus 7. D-Day is the launch and the syndication. D-Day plus 14, that's the signing. And then the closing will be on D-Day plus 21. Three main forms: private placement, preliminary prospectus offering, impact day offerings. A private placement is a bought deal. Essentially, the lead bank agrees to buy up under the subscription agreement, becomes legally obliged to purchase everything, to ensure everything is sold. Under a bought deal, the lead bank buys everything itself and then just places it through its customers, its professional institutional clients. If it's a large public offer, you'll either have a preliminary prospectus offering or an impact day offering. With a preliminary prospectus, you have a pathfinder prospectus or a red herring, which you bring to the market to get a feel for the market so that you can price. You need to determine the price and the coupon. Is it going to be sold at par above par at premium or below par at discount? And then what's the premium, what's the interest going to be? So you need to calculate that. We can use a test, red herring, pathfinder prospectus to get a feel for the market. Otherwise, the investment bank can take all those decisions and then it'll just be determined and announced on the impact day. We call that an impact day offering. A bought deal, as I've said, is a private placement. The lead bank will essentially agree to buy all of the bonds up themselves or notes and then place them in the market through its own institutional structure. Because it's using available exemptions and concessions under regulatory law, there's no public issue. Just in terms of other key ideas, we have immobilisation, dematerialisation, disintermediation, demutualisation, consolidation. Immobilisation, once we sell the bonds or the notes, usually they're always held by a custodian. Euroclear in Brussels, Clearstream in Luxembourg hold most of the bonds issued at the international level. They're valuable, they're bearer instruments, which means title transfers by delivery. We don't want them moving around the market, so we will have them immobilised. Dematerialised is when we issue in an electronic form. In disintermediation is where we set up a programme, so we're going to issue short notes or paper, and we're going to allow the issuer to do it itself without having to go back to the bank. So we disintermediate the banks. Demutualization is when a stock exchange goes from being a private members club to a public company. It demutualizes. And then consolidation is when exchanges take over each other. And we'll come back and look at short exchanges in further detail. All of these notes in commercial paper, what are they in law? They're essentially short-dated, bearer, unsecured, negotiable, withholding tax-free, listed or unlisted, committed or uncommitted promissory notes. In law, that's what they are, under the Bills of Exchange Act 1882. We have a specific definition for a promissory note and for a cheque. A cheque is simply a bill of exchange drawn on a bank, with bill of exchange being defined in sections 3. I think it's sections 3, 63 and 73. I've summarised all of the other key elements of the issue procedure. When we negotiate the documents, when we transfer the documents, when we sign the documents, and then when we exchange the documents, and we exchange in return for that the total issuing price. In practice, what will happen is there will be a 40-day lockdown period after the closing. This is required under the Tax Equity and Fiscal Responsibility Act 1982, TEFRA in the US. This gives the issuer and the lead bank time to declare, confirm that no American citizen is purchasing any of these bonds or notes unless we comply with relevant exemptions under the Securities Act 1933, Securities Exchange Act 1934, or otherwise we need to avoid triggering the Investment Companies Act and the Investment Advisors Act 1940. So there's a 40-day lockdown period. Traditionally, what would happen is the definitive notes are prepared during this time. You need to prepare the big, heavy certificates. That would take up to 3-4 weeks. That was traditionally done during this time, but they were then immobilized. Now, what happens is it's all dematerialized anyway, but you still have the 40-day lockdown period, and then the what's called the temporary global bond or note is replaced by the definitive notes or bonds, either in a physical or dematerialised form. Bonds, I've simply summarised in further detail on this table. So we've got the parties, the arranging bank, the issuer, the public and private investors, the selling group, underwriting syndicate. All of the key issues are summarised on here. Bond structures, issue procedure, documentation structures, market trends, parties, multi-option facilities, a MOF or a MOF, if you're not a MOF or a MOF, MOF, multi-option facility or multi-option funding facility, MOF or MOF, will include a series of options together to give the client maximum possible flexibility. Usually it's a short-term multi-advance, which is a loan. It's a medium-term note program, 5 or 10 year note program. There will be a euro or domestic commercial paper program. There'll be banker's acceptances and a swing line facility. It's a short loan to allow you to transfer funds between any of these other facilities. That's what gives the client maximum flexibility. The initial decision will be to determine, are we going to the banking markets, the credit markets, the euro loan markets, or the bond markets and note market? But once we go to the note and the bond market, are we going shorter duration? And then very often, unless there's a specific reason just for going for a simpler note or bond program, we'll almost always go for a MOF, because that gives the client a medium-term note facility within that, but additional flexibility around that. And then also summarised all of the other issues with regards to the bond market. Historical development, advantage, disadvantage, operational loan and bond provisions, bond variations, bond yields. We've defined all of these at the top. And then all of the other specific issues which apply with regards to the terms of the bond and the legal content of each of those. We've then got project finance. Project finance is infrastructure finance. We're going to build power stations, energy supply grids, we're going to construct harbour systems, motorway systems, desalination plants, information technology systems, hospital systems, hotels, schools. Anything can be done on a project finance basis that has a subsequent income. That income, future stream of funds, will be monetized to pay for the construction, borrowing costs, and all the decommissioning costs as well. What do we have? We have a special purpose vehicle, an issuer. There'll be a shareholders agreement with the project sponsors. There'll be a host government, and then there'll be the institutional lenders. Typically, with project finance, we're going to use syndicated lending, although we could use bonds and notes as well. I've simply summarized the key elements at the top: project concession, limited recourse financing, extended project cycle, risk assessment and allocation, contractual integrity. I've summarised some of the risks on the right-hand side, although I've extended those to around 25 in the paper itself. On the back, we explain the project cycle, the parties, advantage, disadvantage, and all of the documentation involved. We then have securitisation. What we're going to do is we're going to have an asset pool. Any type of credit bank lending relationship, if it's governed on the same identical terms, we can pull it to create a single pooled asset class, and we can sell that through an SPV into the market. The SPV is going to pay for the pool of assets on the bottom left by issuing new notes into the market, usually medium-term notes. So the originating bank is going to transfer this asset pool to an SPV, which pays for it with new security. So we securitize. We convert the lending from being bank-based to securities-based. I've simply summarised some of the key points here. You'll see credit and liquidity enhancement. What we need to do is this. We need to make sure that the notes coming from the SPV are very highly rated. We want AAA, if not AAA. We don't want anything below that, because then it makes it economically much more viable. How do we get AAA rating? There's a series of devices we can use through credit enhancement, which means that this is non-recourse, so the recourse is only against the project through the SPV. Over-collateralization is the easiest thing. If we're transferring a pool worth, let's say, 20 million, we don't transfer 20 million assets, we transfer 21 or 22. We over-collateralize, so there's extra assets that can be sold to cover any losses. If it's 100 million, we transfer 105. It's the simplest, easiest way to provide additional cover. We can have share capital and tranching, subordinated lending, financial guarantees, other forms of security, bonds, insurance, letters of credit, reserve fund accounts, interest rate caps, credit lines. Other facilities can all enhance the credit standing, provide credit support, which means that this SPV, which is only a shell company and a shelf company, we buy it off a shelf in an offshore financial centre. It's a shell company which can do anything, although we will immediately narrow its activities only to conduct all the relevant actions required in connection with this specific transactions and function. I've also summarised all of the core documentation, the legal issues at the bottom there, transfer, finality. We need to ensure that there's a full transfer of title from the originator to the SPV. That has to be what we call bankruptcy remote, so that the SPV can get high credit standing on its new notes, AAA rated. recharacterization. We don't want this to be recharacterized. It has to be a sale, not a loan or a trust or any other type of legal relationship. It has to be a full transfer, a full legal assignment. It has to be bankruptcy remote. There has to be matching. Generally, the note period term of the notes will match the assets down here. If these are 5 years or 10 years, the notes will match. Profit extraction. We're trying to ensure that as much profit is taken from the SPV back to the originator. The SPV does not need to hold any funds at the end of this after 5 or 10 years. So any funds it generates, we want paid back to the originator through various arrangements, including fee service contracts and other types of systems. Enhancement in collateral, ratings, accountancy, taxation, capital, securities, bank regulation. All of that is basic, simple, vanilla, core type securitization. On the back, I've summarized the historical development of the securitization market, parties, regulation and security offerings, documentation, legal and documentation issues. What we can then do is this. We can take the same set of transactions and we can re-securitize. We can secondary securitize. This is what we call structured finance. This is how we create what we call a CDO, a collateralized debt obligation. What we're going to do is we're going to take all these asset pools in after the securitization. We could have 10, 15, 20, up to 100, 200, 350 separate securitizations can be pooled together, and all those assets, all those instruments, those payment streams set transferred up to a new SPV. We call that a CDO, a collateralized debt obligation. When we have 5,000, 10,000 pools of assets going to one SPV under each securitization, we can then take up to 350 of those and securitize those again to a second level SPV. That's called the CDO. If they're all the same assets, it follows the title of the designation of the principal asset class. So if they're all bonds, it's a CBO, collateralized bond obligation. Loans, CLO, equity, CEO, mortgages, CMO, collectively, and if there's any mixed assets involved, it's a CDO, collateralized debt obligation. But what we can also do is this. We can take up to 10, 20, 30, 35 CDOs and securitize them again. That's third level. We call that a CDO squared. And then we can do that again. We can have 5 CDO squareds to have a CDO cubed. Right at the top there. Now, the problem legally simply is this. Do we want to legally assign or equitably assign all of the underlying assets in this pool? So there's 5,000, 10,000 assets in each pool, and then there's 350 of those, and then there's 35 times those, times 5 times those, to get to a squared and a cubed. Basically, we have millions of assets, tens of millions of assets, with hundreds of millions of pages of law possibly. How do we transfer all of that? The point is, in law, we don't. We don't equitably or legally transfer all these assets up each of these stages. What we do is we sell credit protection down from the CDO at the top, sells one CDS, credit default swap is a credit derivative, or you could do it with a credit link note, but usually a credit default swap. Instead of transferring all these assets up to move the legal title up, we sell the risk protection down from the CDO, from the SPV at the top, to the originating bank on the left here. We sell it down in the form of a credit default swap. We call that a synthetic. Instead of moving all these assets up, we sell the credit protection down. During the global financial crisis, this became a bit more complex. This is an example of the type of deal that Goldman Sachs was setting up. They had a whole series of abacus deals and other transactions. And all I've simply done is explain how this operates in practice. We also have, in terms of alternative investment markets, we have hedge funds. Hedge funds are simply regulatory, concessioned-based or structured private investment funds. There's a whole series of statutes we need to be careful of. The Securities Act 33, Securities Exchange Act 1934, the Investment Advisors Act, the Investment Companies Act. We need to avoid all of those. But each of those has limits. 100 investors or qualifying purchasers or a private placement concession or 449 participants or 14 clients. If we stay below each of these,
we avoid all regulatory coverage.
The main one, for example, is the 14 client rule under section 203(b)(3) of the Investment Advisors Act. And there was a famous case called Goldstein. What happens was this: managers only manage 14 hedge funds, because if they only manage 14, they don't have to be registered as advisors under the IAA in America. The SEC said, you're managing a fund. Each of those funds, all the clients in that fund, and there could be 419 or whatever, that's the clients, and those are much more than 14. And the hedge fund said, no, that's not right. We're only managing 14 funds, the funds of the client, not the clients of the funds. And the Supreme Court said, that's right. Hedge funds have a reputation because they invest in aggressive practices. There's a whole series of different types of market practice they follow. Market neutral, global, macro, event driven, directional, arbitrage, long, short, short bias, emerging markets. There's a whole series of specific types of policies, practices they follow. They generate massive amounts of funds. They avoid regulatory coverage by staying just below all of these limits. What's wrong with that? Absolutely nothing. It's perfectly legal, and it's perfectly proper. It's not immoral, and it's not contrary to any regulatory provision. There have been reports and recommendations for change, although nothing's actually come of it as yet. We need some form of indirect control, indirect oversight, but there's nothing wrong with the hedge fund market itself. A more specific type of market is the equity, private equity fund market. Basically, these are funds set up for 10 years, which will invest in a series of companies for up to 3 to 5 years each. They generate large funds on a very similar model to hedge funds. And I've summarized all of these on this table. And again, I've summarized all of the issues that arise with regards to derivatives on this table. And then this is the core master agreement that they use in the financial derivatives area. This is the 2002 is International Association of Swap Dealers master agreement. This is the equivalent of the loan market deal that we looked at. The loan market association documentation is 100 pages, which we summarized down to one page front and back. We can do the same on one page with the ISDA 2002 master agreement. This one document is worth $600 trillion. This is the international finance system. These are international financial markets. And what we do is this: we control the rights and obligations directly, and then indirectly the stability and efficient operation of the markets through the use of private documentation as developed and agreed, executed and signed by clients acting through their lawyers. Essentially, this is to a large extent private documentation based, it's private law based. And it's worked very effectively in practice, and it's expected to continue to do so.